Hello, podcast family. This is Topher Sanders. I'm a reporter here at ProPublica. And today on the ProPublica podcast, we have a very interesting conversation with reporter Jamie Calvin. He recently published his piece on the Chicago Police Department's code of silence for The Intercept. You know, integrity for police officers and the departments they work for has been under immense scrutiny in the past 3 years. And in few cities has that scrutiny been more intense than in Chicago, where Calvin's dogged pursuit of the Laquan McDonald shooting story shined light on a system attempting to scuttle the truth. So he's back with this blistering account of retaliation from two Chicago police officers that say they committed police officers' highest sin, breaking the code of silence to investigate fellow officers. It's a four-part story, and again, it appears on The Intercept. And so we'll be talking with Calvin this week about the difficulty around reporting on whistleblowers, where only a few sources are willing to go on the record, and what weight should be given to finding corroborating evidence. Thanks so much for joining us, Jamie.
Thanks for having me.
3+ years ago, when did you realize that the story that we all read is what you were reporting on, what you were working on? When did you start this process?
When Shannon Spaulding first made contact with me, she was just desperate for somebody to believe this elaborate, complicated, in some ways improbable story she was telling of an extortion racket over any number of years by a group of tactical officers that was in effect being enabled and protected by ranking police officials. And once we started talking, it was apparent that she was, for me, in some ways, the missing part of a puzzle I had been working for many, many years, going back to years of immersion in public housing when I was working as an organizer, as an advisor to residents, but also as a journalist in that setting, doing what we thought of as sort of human rights documentation, but reporting from the ground on conditions in a particular development, Stateway Gardens, that was part of this huge concentration of high-rise public housing on the South Side. And really, within, you know, an hour or two of first talking with Shannon, I realized that there were parallels between our experience, and there were things that I could learn from her that would illuminate questions that I had been trying to make sense of for years as a reporter. But then the piece was ultimately published fully 3.5 years after I met her. So it was really a long process. I didn't work continuously on the piece during that period, but we were in conversation over that period. So it was a long process of figuring out how to construct such a complex narrative, and one that in, you know, many ways sort of challenges people's understanding of how the police department works. And even though, you know, it's called the code of silence, I think it even challenges people's understanding of what the code of silence means.
So how did you arrive at how to do that? Did you lean on colleagues you knew? Like, how did you arrive at how to tell the story?
Well, you know, actually what emerged from multiple conversations, I'm talking ultimately well over 100 hours of, you know, interview-type encounters with Spaulding and many, many more hours with others who figure in the story, you know, at some point it became apparent to me that this was, whatever else in terms of revealing official misconduct and exploring conditions of impunity, it was just a hell of a story. I mean, it was, you know, a tremendous sort of propulsive narrative. And beyond that, and I hope it's apparent to readers of the piece, Spaulding proved to be a really, and her partner Echeverria as well, just really vivid, exact storytellers, command of detail and an ability to sort of evoke what the scene was like. They, you know, so I've actually never had a source able to evoke her circumstances and to recreate encounters as credibly and powerfully as Spaulding does. So it became clear to me that the most powerful way to tell this story was precisely to tell it as a story, to have it sort of enable the reader to come on the same narrative journey that I went on over the years of inquiring into this set of conditions and then constructing a narrative around them. So it was really my excitement about the purely narrative possibilities. And that's what it felt like this story required. All sorts of questions remained about how to do it and how to do it in a way that honored journalistic standards of care and rigor.
When you first sit with, you know, Miss Spaulding, and she tells you this story, and it is, you know, this incredible tragedy, at what point do you get to the place where you, like, you believe her and you're ready to go down the road with her on this journey to report out this really incredible story?
It's a really good question. So, first of all, I come to the conversation with my body of experience over many years in public housing, some experiences and questions of my own are very much part of the context in which I initially hear her. But it takes, I can't locate the exact point in our relationship over time and in the process, but it took a number of conversations, partly because of the sheer complexity of the story, the number of characters, the number of different storylines that are sort of braided into this. It took a while for me to get to the point that I had confidence that it was a story I was capable of telling. There was a juncture where I was increasingly convinced of her credibility, by which I mean not that everything that comes out of her mouth, you know, I believed, and I tried to tell the story in what is still a sort of contingent way. You know, this is her story, her truth, that I'm trying to do justice to. So there's a point at which I fully grasp that this is a really credible person who's risked a great deal to tell this story. And then there was another point, I think, considerably further down the process where I developed a conviction that this is a story I can tell. I can do this. And at that point, I was all in. There was nothing tentative. I was all in. And it's a very long piece as published. I essentially had to write a book to write an article in this case because of the complexity, because of the, you know, the context that people, you could not assume your reader was familiar with and that had to be evoked, you know, conditions on the ground in public housing, sort of internal workings of the Internal Affairs Bureau within the police department. So I have to say, I mean, I feel like it used every tool I have as a writer to try to do justice to the story. Yeah, it was those two questions, her credibility, and then, you know, she could be a wonderful source and credible, and I could still be flummoxed in figuring out how to tell the story. And I hope what we came up with is the best possible telling of it.
How difficult was it to put together a story like this, where essentially everyone else you go to talk to besides your two detectives wanted nothing to do with you?
Yeah. So I think that's been the challenge. And I think it's a really fundamental challenge. And I've come to feel very strongly personally that it's a question that we should be addressing as journalists. And I don't think there's only one perspective on it. If somebody, you know, Edward Snowden comes to us as journalists with a treasure trove of documents, we know what to do with that kind of whistleblower, right? We will harvest those documents for stories. When somebody comes in the vein of Shannon Spaulding at great risk and at great cost with a story to tell that there's very little documentary support for that's available to me as a reporter and that can only be corroborated at certain points but not in its whole, you know, narrative thrust, what are our responsibilities at that point? How do we report that kind of a story responsibly? And I go even further when this is, in fact, a story. She's telling the story in the face of official denials up and down the food chain within the police department. But the very subject of the story, in this case, is the code of silence, is now much observed and much documented phenomena of police departments and other institutions sort of fabricating their own version of reality, their own official narrative. That was a puzzle because the normal journalistic conventions, apart from, you know, double sourcing and looking for documentary
evidence and things in the public record in support of serious allegations of the nature that are made by Spalding in this article. You also have the practice of allowing for seeking comment from those who are named and those who are the subject of allegations. In this case, you know, only a handful of people would talk to me in the depositions and sworn statements that emerged and the whistleblower suit that Spalding and her partner ultimately brought against various named defendant police officers and against the city. There are blanket denials by various of the individuals who figure in the story as allegedly retaliating against Spalding and her partner. So how to navigate and advance a narrative that fully acknowledges the denials and makes them available, but also allows space and oxygen for Spalding to tell her story? And you could imagine, I think if I had tried to do this with all sorts of media outlets, the only way they would have published the story would have been if I layered in official denials almost paragraph by paragraph, you know. And that would have, to my mind, have muffled Spalding's voice in a way that would have been a disservice to her and to readers. I was very happy to land ultimately at The Intercept, where the editors there sort of embraced my vision of how the story should be told and then brought so much capacity and rigor to fact-checking, sourcing, assessing almost sentence by sentence every aspect of the story in order ultimately to tell it in the way I believed and believe it needs to be told. It's complicated, and I think every case is going to be different, but there's a danger, and this is what we tried to avoid with this, that, you know, a lot of things are arrayed against a whistleblower. There aren't very many happy whistleblower stories. Whistleblowers often have tremendously salutary effect on public institutions, but have their lives seriously damaged in the process. The odds are heavily against them. And what I was concerned about in telling this story is that I didn't want journalistic conventions to sort of aid and abet the code of silence. These aren't really questions of interpretation because some of these statements are just absolute sweeping blanket denials. Never saw her, never talked with her, never interacted with her. So ultimately it was possible to construct the piece to kind of use the official denials to really have the kicker, the point to which the piece delivers you, be this question, which I think is an open question right now that I hope further reporting and investigation will ultimately be able to answer. But if she's telling the truth, and I think there's strong reason to believe that she is, then the city of Chicago in the post-Laquan McDonald era was prepared to offer a defense against charges of retaliation under the Code of Silence that was itself an embodiment of the Code of Silence. So I think this is a story that's far from over, and I think we'll find out some things downstream and some things that may actually, for me and for others, inform how we assess the journalistic strategy we used for Lana.
That was fantastic, and it really opened up the lane for a couple of other questions that I have. Kind of going to being, you know, the reporter who is a human, right? We all have emotions along these journeys as we're trying to put together these difficult and challenging stories, and you kind of highlighted a couple of them there. One is the idea of finding a home for this story. So in full disclosure, it's my understanding that you even communicated with ProPublica about this story.
I actually did early on, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so as you're facing these challenges along in the journalism and then seeing it confronted as you also are discussing this story with potential publishers, talk to me about the challenge in that. You found my source is credible. This is an important story. And now the challenge begins to find a place that will see this vision the way I see this vision.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you remind me, I did reach out to ProPublica, and I should be clear that the reason, you know, I've had contact with the Center for Investigative Reporting, also at both Slate and The Guardian wanted the piece, but ultimately wanted to make radical changes in it because of anxieties about legal exposure. You know, what I wanted, you bring it back to me and reaching out to ProPublica, to CIR, and what I ultimately found with The Intercept is I'm an independent reporter. I cannot possibly publish this kind of piece without editorial and legal vetting. I need other eyeballs. I need to be challenged about the reporting. I recognize that. That's part of my, you know, my practice. And it can be really hard to find that. You know, with a piece of, on this scale and with the gravity of some of the allegations that it contains, that editorial vetting and engagement is critical. And so, you know, I look to CIR, to ProPublica as really the gold standards in investigative reporting and sort of came looking for help. And then, you know, had folks, both really editors, I want to be clear in the case of both The Guardian and Slate, editors, case of Slate, I've worked with in the past very happily, have high regard for equally at The Guardian. So I'm not, I don't want to be running anybody down in this. It's that we couldn't ultimately come to agreement about how the story should be told. And the things that, you know, ultimately caused a parting of the way were, to my mind, solutions to problems that are real problems and how you tell a story like this that just did disproportionate, you know, damage to the story. So from the start, my need and really hunger was to find editorial support, scrutiny, and above all, challenge. You know, what you need with a story like this is to be challenged. You know, how do you know this to the extent that a given statement is hearsay or conjectural? You know, how exactly do we phrase that so that we can defend it if we need to from attack? It's been a very instructive process for me. I couldn't be happier about how it has ultimately landed. And I welcome this conversation because I feel like there are some questions and issues sort of exemplified by this story that we should be thinking about. I did an interview the other day with a good friend, Jim Warren, who loves the piece and used to be managing editor of the Tribune in Chicago. And, you know, as we talked, he did a gut check and said, you know, I would not have published this. I would not have been able to publish it.
Did he say why?
Yeah, I think just the sense of exposure, the possibility of blowback, and this underlying question of, I mean, he was also saying, you know, my legal department wouldn't let me do it, however much I might like it. I probably shouldn't speak for him in this. So I recognize that there's a degree of pushing the envelope with a story like this, but I want to suggest that we have an obligation not just to the Edward Snowdens, but to whistleblowers whose stories in the nature of things can only partially be corroborated. I mean, take an example. Let's imagine that somebody escapes from a human trafficking criminal enterprise. They've gone through hell. They have a critically important and compelling story to tell. It's the nature of that criminal enterprise to deny its own very existence. And any inquiry will be met with that kind of flat denial. It's also the nature of what the source has undergone that they can't corroborate it very much in conventional ways. Is it appropriate for us not to tell that story than, you know, the stories we routinely do where it's easy to double source and it's easy to find corroborating documents, and if it's a conversation reported of multiple people, to check with everybody else who was in the room? There's some stories that are just critically important stories to tell where that is not going to be possible. I'm not saying that my reporting on this is unique. There are lots of stories, well-done stories, that I think are built on the same lines. But I don't think there's enough discussion about the distinction between the whistleblower who brings you the documents and the whistleblower who has critically important information that they're prepared to share and at considerable costs and risk, that you're not, you know, having made
over time and, you know, multiple encounters and interviews, your own assessments of credibility, even if you come to believe, you know, in your deepest narrow that this person is telling the truth, you're still going to be limited in what you can provide by way of corroboration. What do we do at that moment? That was the puzzle in this question, in this story.
How much time did you spend searching for that corroboration? You know, trying to find whatever email, text message, other folks on the street, other drug dealers, Monk. How much time did you spend trying to find that corroboration?
A fair amount, you know, especially in this last stage. I mean, there was a certain amount early on. And then, you know, I also have a lot of street contacts sort of from those days when public housing high rises were up. And I talked to a lot of people about Watts and about the sort of larger phenomena of these sort of protection rackets where police would have a standing agreement with particular groups of drug dealers. A fair amount of that, and then reaching out to other officers who are implicated in the story, some of whom have cooperated with me. One of the major resources that I ended up spending a lot of time working through was deposition testimony and sworn statements and other legal documents in connection, you know, thousands of pages of legal documents in connection with the whistleblower suit that Spalding and Echeverria brought. You know, and this turned out to be a really rich resource, but just to give you a sense of the flavor of the process with The Intercept, at a fairly early stage, you know, in the process of vetting the manuscript, I produced an annotated version of the manuscript where I linked and footnoted to any and all material that could corroborate various statements made. It was actually, this was while the piece, I mean, hadn't gone through final editing, but was pretty much fully baked on my part. And to go back and for a second time dive into the pretty voluminous record that had been created in the course of civil discovery before the case settled, it was almost like mapping the piece in terms of what portions of it could be supported in the public record and what portions could not. And I think that phase of the process then informed subsequent processes where The Intercept was much more comfortable about the telling of the description of a particular encounter or scene if that had also been talked about in Spalding or Echeverria's deposition, or where we could cite denials in the depositions of various of the officer defendants. It kind of informed the process going forward, so that there also are moments and scenes where there's no such support. So how do we phrase the recounting or retelling of a story that has no support in the documentary record? You know, again, I want to convey that once this piece had been fully reported and fully written, there was the most intense sentence-by-sentence scrutiny of it by editors, fact-checkers, and, you know, ultimately lawyers. It's a better piece by virtue of that, but it's also, I mean, happily, the piece I intended to write in the first instance. But there was a tremendous amount of journalistic due diligence to get it to a point where everybody was comfortable and confident and, you know, we could publish it.
Talk to me about the process of unfortunately, what seems like more people than not telling you no on the record, at least. And maybe, I don't know if there were lots of off-the-record conversations.
Yeah, there were a handful of off-the-record conversations, but mostly people, meaning those named in the story, used the fact that the litigation was pending. Even if they weren't defendants, they were on witness lists or they were named in some fashion in the context of the litigation. So that became a kind of sweeping basis for refusing to talk to me. I went to the chief lawyer for the city with whom I have a relationship. I went to lawyers for individual defendants. I went to actually the head of the police union, the Fraternal Order of Police, you know, hoping that I would get some help in reaching and inducing some of the individuals mentioned to speak with me, with a couple of exceptions. That was unavailing.
With the difficulty to talk to people, the flat-out denials, and I have to say some of the denials are just incredible, where you know you have some folks saying, actual meetings in garages that Spalding very eloquently details just didn't even happen. I didn't even see her that day. Like, you know, just flat out denials. Was there ever a moment for you where you started to question the story, question credibility? Did that ever arise as you started to get heavy into reporting and just the corroboration wasn't there?
You know, that's a really good question. I think that's always a tension. You know, the point I made before about needing other eyeballs. I mean, you want people to keep you self-skeptical about your reporting. I think you can contrast by your own story. And I very much wanted to be challenged on that account. I have to say, as it went forward, I can't count the number of times circled back with Spalding, particularly also with Echeverria, to go over a scene again to just be sure that they told it the same way. And, you know, and all of that came out of a concern that, could I be wanting this story too much? Could I be deluding myself? Could I be dialing back my own critical faculties and how I'm proceeding? The accumulating denials, as the denials came in and as I cataloged them in the legal documents, I have to say that actually built my confidence in the story. Because remember, this is a story about official denial. This is a story about the code of silence. And those sweeping denials put up against, you know, really extended narrative, and in my case, going back over and over again with Spalding, the same scenes and situations, and having her never really vary in her telling. So, you know, over time, I hope this happens for the reader. It certainly happened for me over the last 3 years. You come very gradually to assessments of other people's credibility. And I'm not saying that those are bankable, definitive knowledge that they're telling the truth, but they matter. They matter nonetheless. And so as I was gaining that, you know, that sense that there's the feel of truth here, you know, I was sort of gathering in these encyclopedic denials from everybody else who was alleged to be involved or to have participated in retaliation or to have been in this conversation or that conversation. And it was really the blanket denials of the code of silence that seemed to me the ultimate example of the code of silence. The code of silence about the code of silence, even though, you know, I have lots of questions in my mind to this day about what happened at certain junctures in this story, I have very little doubt that what we are seeing in those legal documents and in those public utterances that we have is an example of the very subject of the story. So in a curious way, it increased my confidence rather than undermining it.
Thank you so very much, Jamie. And I think that this was really, really illuminating. And so I really appreciate you taking some time to talk with us.
Thanks, Topher. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for having me.
That was a great conversation. Thank you again, Jamie. And thank you all for listening to the ProPublica podcast. I look forward to seeing you next week.